Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. Today it's a special episode because not only am I joined by Nick, but I'm also joined by a very good friend of the show, Michael Howell. He's the CEO of Cross Border Capital, of course, the global liquidity savant. It's quarterly at this point, but we're very happy to have him on the show once again. Michael, how are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Joe. Very good to be here again and good to meet Nick.
Absolutely. It's always a good conversation with you. So let's get the ball rolling straight away here. When we talked last, and this was early February, the bull market was raging on. It still is raging on. We went through a bit of a correction, but you advised that while the party continues, it might make sense to dance near the door, per se. There were some conditions happening in the background that were a little bit disconcerting. I suppose now, 3 months later, just about, give us your updated overview on global liquidity and where we're headed.
Okay, well, I mean, as you know, our view is that global liquidity is pretty much all that matters. You've got to understand effectively where money is flowing in the global financial system, and that's what we track. We think that the trend is basically upwards over the medium term. The doubt we had, or the concern we had maybe over the course of the last one or two quarters, is that basically what you've got is a situation where there was likely to be an air pocket, and that air pocket was being driven by the Federal Reserve, and it was largely because of the tax filing date, April 15th, I believe, which was likely to take a lot of money out of US money markets. So if you add that factor, or let's say accurately subtract that factor, it's a dip in liquidity. The other thing that was going on in the background was China. And if there are two really important central banks in the system, it's basically the Federal Reserve and it's the People's Bank of China. And what you had was not just the Federal Reserve maybe touching the brake pedal a tad, you also had the People's Bank of China withdrawing liquidity from the system. Now, that was important in the context that really for most of the second half of last year, China was actually pushing huge amounts of liquidity into their financial markets. And they basically stopped after the Lunar New Year period, largely because the yuan, the Chinese currency, was coming under a lot of pressure and they needed to tighten money markets. So what you had is the two big players in the system basically withdrawing liquidity. And that air pocket is something that we were concerned about. And I think it's really behind some of the corrections we're getting in risk asset markets right now. But the trend, let me say, behind that is still likely upwards. And we still believe that our framework is telling us that, you know, the low in the cycle was, let's say, October, around October of 2022, just after the British gilt debacle. And the peak is likely to be in late 2025.
Now, Michael, we understand that there are so many components to your liquidity index coming from central banks all over the world, as well as commercial banks. Tell us what you believe will be the main contributors toward a boost in the global liquidity index going forward for the rest of the year.
Okay, for the rest of the year, I think it's likely to be central bank easing. And I think you can see around the world, maybe stepping outside of the US for a moment, but a lot of central banks are very keen to ease policy. You've seen that actually even today in the case of Britain, where the British Chancellor, the Finance Minister, has actually cautioned the Bank of England on making too rapid interest rate cuts, which is an astonishing statement in itself, to say that actually a finance minister is saying don't cut rates so aggressively. So you've got that backdrop. You've got Japan, where, you know, there is a seeming reluctance to actually rein in the weakening yen by an aggressive tightening of monetary policy. And we know that from in Europe, mainland Europe, the ECB is basically talking pretty openly about cutting interest rates in the next maybe 4 weeks or so. So what you have is a backdrop where many other central banks are actually very interested in easing policy. And I think given the backdrop of sluggish economies, there is really a willingness or an openness to actually ease policy. I think the slower party out there is the Federal Reserve. I suspect that is likely to speed up. I think that what you will see in the period in the run-up to the election is probably a lot more stimulus coming out of the Fed through the balance sheet. We already have one hint of that with the tapering of the QT program. We always thought that was likely, you know, around Q1, Q2 of this year, and, you know, it's happened. It's been a little bit more maybe aggressive in the tapering than we envisioned first off, but clearly that's happening. And I think you've got the other dynamic which is likely to come through, which is that the Treasury is likely to run down its balance at the Fed a lot more aggressively, maybe, than people are thinking. And that is, you know, I think that Janet, in her QRA, or the QRA announcement from the Treasury, was very, very conservative about the size of the Treasury General Account. This is getting a bit in the weeds here, but they were very conservative about the level of the Treasury General Account. But I think that was really to make a statement that they didn't want to, you know, give a sense that they were goosing the markets ahead of the election. So that may be just plain politics, but I figure they will do. I mean, I think it's unlikely that it's going to stay up at these elevated levels. So more liquidity is coming, basically.
The Bitcoin Layer is very proud to be sponsored by River, a Bitcoin-only exchange and who we believe to be the leader in the business. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 of Bitcoin for free when you go sign up. You have a lot of options when it comes to buying Bitcoin. We believe River is your best choice because they do not custody your Bitcoin on a third-party exchange. They have their own solution for storage, and they encourage you to get your coins off the exchange as soon as possible. River.com/TBL for that special offer. Now, do you feel that Bitcoin is a leading indicator of your liquidity index, or that it's concurrent? Because I know that you're focusing on the Bitcoin price as a tell, and you are joining podcasts like ours because you know that from the Bitcoin side, we're focused on global liquidity because we see it as a driver. So I'm wondering what you feel about the Bitcoin price. Does it lead, or is it concurrent, or does it slightly lag? How do you view it?
Well, I think the answer is let's look at the data. I think it's very difficult to argue why the Bitcoin price should lead. And I think there's a compelling theoretical argument as to why it should lag. And if you look at the evidence from the data, it's pretty clear that it does lag. Now, having said that, the lag is relatively short from our experience in looking at other assets. So what you would normally say, for example, I mean, this is a very broad summary, but equity markets tend to get a kicker from liquidity traditionally after about 6 to 9 months. That's normally the lead time. The real economies are more stretched out. That's more about 15 months or so before you get any traction from the real economy. The fixed income markets and the Forex markets are a lot more sensitive, and they tend to get their kicker about 3 months to 6 months after a turn in liquidity. You know, for example, this, a lot of our analysis goes back to the time that I was in Salomon Brothers. And as you will know, or many people will know, Salomon Brothers was the biggest fixed income player worldwide. And we used to look very, very closely at these monetary flows. And what you found was that as liquidity came into the system, whether it was from the Fed or other players, it tended to shift the term structure about 8 to 9 months after an initial shock. So that's the sort of lead times you kind of expect in financial assets. For Bitcoin, it seems to be much, much shorter. It's in a period of about sort of 6 to 8 weeks from what our analysis shows. And we've done very thorough analysis looking at weekly data. And we've actually incorporated that using Granger causality tests, looking at a structural VAR, that's a vector autoregression model, try and understand how some of these shocks pan out. And it comes out statistically significant with that kind of lead time. Now, interestingly, if you also factor gold bullion into that equation, gold tends to be, responsive to liquidity. You've got to say that it has a lower sensitivity than Bitcoin or Ethereum, but it tends also to respond rather later. So that's more in the normal Forex camp of being about 3 to 6 months afterwards.
Excellent. And I have the chart here that is in your chart deck that kind of illustrates this. You see here, gold and crypto obviously bundled together following global liquidity and then following US CPI. Clearly here, US CPI is not a very good basket if you're trying to track liquidity. And it seems like these assets have done a pretty bang up job with it.
Yeah. And I think, Joe, it's worthwhile making this distinction or drawing this distinction, because the word inflation is used very widely. But let's kind of drill down and really examine what we mean here. What we're talking about when we talk about monetary inflation is this expansion in global liquidity that we're seeing. In other words, on the chart, it's the black line that you see published there. And the orange line is the market capitalization, the size of the gold bullion market plus the crypto market. So those two factors together are really matching over the long term the movements in global liquidity. Now, that is a monetary inflation. In other words, it's a devaluation in the value of paper money. What you've got alongside on that chart is a broken line at the bottom, which is actually US CPI. That is high street inflation. High street inflation and monetary inflation are not the same thing. Monetary inflation is an ingredient into high street inflation, but it's not the whole story. What you've also got to take into account are what's happening to costs. And costs can be factors like oil prices. It can be factors like technology gains. In other words, the big boost to productivity that's coming through IT or ultimately AI. It could equally be, the impact of China and the fact that China is dumping very cheap goods into the American high street, and therefore prices are coming down. So that gap between the black line and the broken line is basically telling you that over time, there has been cost deflation. In other words, costs have come down. So if you look at what is the future for inflation in the American high street, it's basically a monetary inflation by the Federal Reserve or the fiscal authorities, plus what cost gains you can get or what cost productivity gains you can get from industry. Now, it may well be that we're underestimating the AI gains or the technology gains, but we may equally be overestimating the impact of China in the future, because China is unlikely to be such a major supplier, as one is led to understand, into the Western economies in the future, given tariffs and whatever else. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts, but you kind of get the idea. There are two moving parts in terms of high street prices.
Now, when you talk about the monetary inflation, you have in the past referenced the monetization of T-bills at the commercial banking level, mm-hmm. that commercial banks are absorbing a massive influx of supply of treasury bills, and that in that as the commercial banks expand their balance sheet to absorb these T-bills, that this is a monetization of bills through the banking sector, not through the Federal Reserve. So correct. I'd like to understand the mechanics a little bit more of this. Does this happen because commercial banks are funding their T-bill purchases through the repo market? And what I'm also curious about is that the TGA side of it, the TGA gets funded only when reserves are debited at the Federal Reserve account. So reserves do flood into the TGA when T-bills are issued, but it's my understanding that the commercial bank system is expanding to absorb this, and that they are able to expand the system via repo. So I was hoping that you can explain this concept to us and get as deep into the mechanics as you'd like.
Yeah, I think it's, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, if you've got whatever the debt is, whether it's coupon debt or whether it's bills, if those instruments, those securities are bought by a credit provider, that is monetization. In other words, they're using their balance sheet to fund the federal government. So in other words, what you've got to think about is a situation where the government writes a check to you or I, we put it in our bank account, that increases the size of the liabilities of the banks, but the banks have got to match that with assets. So if they basically buy government paper, that is direct monetization. On the other hand, if the government sells to the private sector, the non-bank private sector, then all you're doing is you're swapping a bank deposit for a longer dated coupon bond. So that's not a monetization. If the banks, i.e. the credit providers, buy the debt, then that's a direct monetization. And the point being, and the point that I'm trying to make in those comments, is that banks don't tend to buy long-dated coupons. They tend to buy very short-dated coupons and bills. They have a tremendous appetite for bills. So, you know, they are the big buyers when you get treasury bill issuance. So if Janet is leaning more towards bill financing, then you're going to see the banks hoover up more of this, and that is a direct monetization. And what I've argued recently is if you look at the statement that came out both of the Federal Reserve and of the Treasury with the quarterly refunding announcement in the last few weeks, what you've actually seen there, I would argue, is a direct is an accord, a so-called accord between these two bodies. Maybe that's no great surprise, but what they're working towards is duration management. So they're trying to limit the supply of coupon in the system. And whether that's the Federal Reserve saying, well, look, hey, we're not going to roll off so many from our balance sheet, or whether it's Janet saying, we're not going to issue so many. We're keeping the calendar pretty much level here in terms of coupons. And any swing payments in the fiscal deficit is basically covered by bills. Now, what that will mean is presumably the bill issuance will go up over time. And that will break the longer-term assumption that we've always held that Treasury funding is about one-fifth bills, four-fifths coupon. And I would imagine that's going to drift higher over time. It has to.
And for our understanding, that does two things. Number one, when commercial banks monetize the debt by being credit providers, expanding their balance sheet, it boosts global liquidity because you have the asset side of commercial banks growing. Mm-hmm. And that boosts global liquidity. On the other side, you don't have the duration hit to the market when you're issuing bills. So duration won't sell off as much as it would. That boosts the prices of the collateral within the system. And that also boosts Michael's global liquidity index. And so from both of these sides, what you're getting is a boost in global liquidity. And so then a boost to risk assets. And then hopefully for the administration, you know, a favorable look from the electorate. Is that accurate?
That is 100% correct. And that is the way to look at it. Looking at T accounts, as people do, misses the point here, okay? Because, you know, clearly every asset has a liability and every liability has an asset. So by definition, they're going to balance. But what you need to take into account is duration. And, you know, I occasionally give talks at business schools about liquidity and what's going on. And I always start those talks by saying, look, in finance, the most important concept to understand is duration, okay? In other words, Macaulay duration. It's a wonkish finance concept, but you will understand it. But it's something that you really need to understand, because what it shows is it's a measure of the average timing of cash payments over time. And a duration of 5 years tells you that you're going to get your payment, your cash payment, on average after 5 years. So duration is a really, really important point in financial markets, because financial markets wouldn't exist if there was no duration, by definition. So you've got to take duration into account. Effectively, what we're really saying is liquidity is kind of the ratio between assets or liabilities and their duration. And that is really what matters. So you can get a change in liquidity if the pool of assets changes, or if the duration mix of those assets changes.
Michael, one day I dream that you will visit Los Angeles and guest lecture with me on campus and explain this concept to the students to layer on, because duration is basically the first concept I teach. After I introduce fixed income, we go into duration, then we go into portfolio management. I want to ask you, before I hand it back to Joe, you mentioned in a recent interview the Shanghai Accord a half decade ago, or actually almost a decade ago now. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in Japan with the devaluation of their currency? And you also mentioned here China facing pressure on its currency and therefore having to go backwards on providing liquidity to the market. So I was hoping that you could go to Asia for a second, give us your whole overview, and help us understand the currency war over there. What is happening?
Okay, well, this goes back to actually the book I wrote called Capital Wars a few years ago. And what Capital Wars is really about is saying that there is a tussle going on between, if you like, the great powers, but it's being fought out in financial markets and currency markets, rather less on the battlefield, if you like, traditional battlefield. And what you've got is a tussle between the dollar as the preeminent currency worldwide, and rivals that are coming through, of which the Chinese are kind of posting the yuan as their rival vehicle. Now, as it happens, China is a de facto a dollarized economy, effectively. And what China needs to do is to get off the dollar hook and basically try and export yuan to the rest of the world in the same way that America exports dollars. One of the things that that book says, maybe controversially, maybe not, is that the whole idea that Bretton Woods ended in 1971 is a complete fiction. Okay, maybe it's a convenient fiction, but it's a fiction. Bretton Woods still exists. The Bretton Woods deal was all about putting the US dollar at the center of the global financial system. Since 1971, that has got even stronger, not weaker. Okay, the Bretton Woods up to 1971 was basically trade dominated. Since 1971, it's been capital flow dominated. But the dollar is the preeminent currency worldwide, and there are absolutely no challenges to that as far as one can see. It would be really, really difficult for China to even, you know, scratch the surface here. But clearly they're trying. And one of the things that occurred in 2016 was that China was facing the prospect of a weakening yuan when the dollar generally was strong. And at a G20 meeting in Shanghai in early 2016, there was a secretive deal to basically stabilize Asian currencies. Now, it, as I say, it was secret, it wasn't publicized, but there's a lot of stuff on the internet about that Shanghai Accord. And if you look at the period from early 2016 to early 2022, the degree of volatility, or the degree of stability, if you like, in Asian currencies is unprecedented. You've never seen anything like the stability. Effectively, a basket of Asian currencies flatlines through that whole period, okay? Very, very unusual. Even in the official Bretton Woods period, Asian currencies were not as stable as they were in the last, in that 5-year, 6-year period. Now, what then happened? Let me just say, why is that important? Because if China is the linchpin around that Shanghai Accord, the Chinese yuan, and China was through that period operating monetary policy to stabilize the yuan, if you look at their monetary operations, it was definitively doing that. It gives China an ability to then promote the yuan as a rival to the dollar, because you've got a stable store of value in the system and other people can hold the yuan, okay, as either a vehicle currency or as a store of value. What you saw in March of 2022, interestingly, but we can leave that for another debate, it coincided with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but that may be another story. Who knows, that may be linked, it may not be. What you saw was the Japanese yen starting to weaken furiously. Now, a lot of people have been arguing for a long time that the yen is structurally undervalued because they look at trade surpluses and they ignore the fact that actually we're not in a world of trade now, in a world of capital. The yen started to weaken furiously. In all my years of working in financial markets, which is now totting up to be quite a large number, I have never seen a major currency weaken with the speed that the yen weakened through that 2 or 3 month period from early 2022. Markets are not as ruthless for major currencies as that. Governments are. So this seemed to me to be a government-led move. In other words, there was something going on. If governments wanted to manipulate one particular cross among the major crosses, the yen dollar is the easiest one to manipulate. And I suspect there was something going on. Now, if you now come up to date, what you find is that coming into early 2024, the consensus view out there was that the Japanese yen was the best trade of the year. Almost everyone was saying, look, the yen's going to rocket here. It's going to move up. It's going to go back from whatever it was, 140 or thereabouts, back to 110. You know, you've got a structural rise in the yen coming. Wrong, because the yen is instrumental here in weakening the Chinese yuan and destroying the Shanghai Accord. The Shanghai Accord is in tatters. It doesn't exist anymore. Asian currencies are volatile. There's been a huge step down. And nobody in their right mind would want to hold the yuan because it looks as if it's got to devalue more. And the trigger for that, which put all the pressure on the Chinese, was the weakening Japanese yen, because this is a competitor currency in the region. So to my mind, and I could, of course, be completely wrong here, but my mind, my instinct tells me the yen was a stalking horse, a Trojan horse, if you like, to weaken the Chinese financial system and basically underscore dollar preeminence. Now, in all that period, and let me just finish with this comment, in all that period, did the US Treasury put its hand up and say, hey, look, this is unfair competition. Why is the yen devaluing so much? This is a major trade partner of America. Surely this is unfair competition. The Japanese are sort of, you know, potentially dumping goods on America at cheap prices. Unfair. Because they said that about Vietnam when the Vietnamese devalued the dong by a much smaller amount. And Vietnam, hey, is not anything like as important in Japan as Japan to American trade. But the Treasury were completely silent about Japan, but they kicked up a fuss about Vietnam. So what's going on? I think it's a stalking horse. And I think what you've got is a deliberate weakening in the yen. And what you're looking at, or what we're facing here, is a Chinese yuan that is going to devalue to about 8 against the US dollar. And that's what I think is going on.
Very well said. I want to shift gears here briefly to the Fed. And then I do want to ask about China and demographics. You had a chart in here, and one of the bullet points that you talked about was that the Fed liquidity could surge over the coming months as the US Treasury forces the end of QT. We just saw that the Fed did announce the taper that everybody was expecting. And you have this chart right here. Walk us through how the tapering of the Fed's balance sheet impacts Fed liquidity, and then how you define Fed liquidity, and then the impact that that's going to have on risk markets.
Okay, the point about the chart is that what you've got there is principally two lines. The red line that you can see, the higher line, is looking at the size, the reported size of the Fed balance sheet. And that is what the Fed has got all of us to focus on, or the markets to focus on, as a measure of their QT process. So in other words, that, you know, go back 3 years, an increasing Fed balance sheet was good. Now a falling Fed balance sheet is good. I didn't quite work out the difference, but anyway, that's the rhetoric that comes out of policymakers. But the issue is that the balance sheet per se is not entirely liquidity creating. Some elements on the balance sheet actually withdraw liquidity from the system. Some have no effect. And what you've got to do is single out those elements that are liquidity creating. And that's what we do in the orange line. And that's what I wrote about 5 or 6 years ago in the book Capital Wars. We went through the Fed balance sheet and tried to understand some of these ingredients and why it's important to actually analyze these various components. Now, there are basically 3 major items on the Fed balance sheet to think about. You've got the bulk of the asset side, which is, you can think of as Fed credit. And if anyone wants to follow this, this narrative with numbers, look at the H4.1 release that comes out 4:30 every Thursday in the US. So that's published by the Federal Reserve. That's their press release. And all these numbers are crystal clear. So Fed credit is the bulk of the asset side of the balance sheet. Now, that per se would create liquidity in the system. It would load up US money markets with cash. Apart from the fact there are 2 drains coming up. One of those drains is what's called the Treasury General Account, which is basically money that the federal government holds in a bank account, is not circulating in the system, and it holds it on the Fed balance sheet. So you've got to remove that. The other element is basically a relatively newfangled element, which is called the reverse repo program or facility, which is basically money which is, again, out of circulation. It's held on the Fed balance sheet, and it was really a replacement for the excessive bill issuance that occurred during the COVID crisis, when essentially those Treasury bills absorbed all the transfer payments that were pushed through into bank deposit accounts. So as the bill issuance dried up, so the Federal Reserve, to preserve the integrity of its interest rate policy, issued the reverse repo accounts. Now, what you've got going on in the system is that the red line is still going down, although it's going down at a slower pace. And you can see the step up when Silicon Valley Bank blew up on the chart. And what you've also got, as you can see, is an inflection around that time. It was actually coincident with the British gilt crisis and the SVB crisis in the orange line. And that inflection is basically causing liquidity to rise. And that's largely because the reverse repo account has been run down aggressively, releasing liquidity back into the system. And the Treasury General Account has sort of swung around a bit. And the latest step down in that orange line is because the Treasury General Account jumped with tax filing in the US after April 15. And what you've had is a lot of money entering the treasury and therefore coming out of bank deposit accounts, coming out of the money markets and out of circulation. And the dotted lines there represent our projections. And so what we envision here is there'll be a slow climb back. Now, the problem with that particular statement is that what does it mean for bank reserves? And the way that we think about this is that this is the input, if you like, which is pouring money into the money markets. What comes out the other end feeds into bank reserves. So bank reserves pretty much move pari passu with that orange line. And so what you'd expect is a dip in bank reserves that you're getting now and a slow recovery up. Our concern is that that pushes some of the regional banks below their so-called adequate reserve threshold, and it may create some problems. And I don't think that Janet wants to face problems ahead of the election. So I would fully expect the Federal Reserve to focus more and more on trying to get liquidity levels up again.
And speaking very briefly of the adequate reserve level, I actually have a chart that showcases the adequate reserve level for both small and large banks. And I'd like to get your thoughts on it very briefly before I pass it back to Nick, because it does touch on exactly what you were talking about there, in that bank reserves are kind of at a bit of a scary level right now, where they're bumping up against what would be considered their reserve constraint. So here, just to explain this chart for you, because it is new and we didn't talk about it beforehand, this right here is the reserve constraint level historically. The reason I marked it there is because bank reserves have never been able to dip below this level. They tried to in 2018, they failed. And it's also the level that they bounced off of when Silicon Valley Bank cratered. And with the Bank Term Funding Program, bank reserves, and this is small bank cash reserves as a percentage of their total assets. And thanks to BTFP, this is where they were. But now without BTFP, we're kind of right below that level once again in this red dashed line. This was with BTFP. The facility is no more. Loans are being paid back. So we're right under this reserve constraint level. So I guess I'm curious in your thoughts on this. How close are we with bank reserves to what would be considered this reserve constraint level? And what should policymakers have in mind when they're thinking about these things?
Well, I think the answer is that nobody really knows, okay? And that may be an astonishing admission, but really nobody knows. And if you look, and there's a chart in one of our presentations or one of our reports that I put together, which basically shows over time the Federal Reserve's own estimates of adequate reserves in the system, okay? And you plot that and it draws out an exponential curve. So in other words, over time, they've upped this minimum reserve level many, many, many times. So they've got no idea what it is. And so how should we? Now, my view is that I draw up a similar chart to the one that you show there, Joe, but actually my dotted line for the reserve constraint has a slight upward trend in it over time as the system expands. And I think we're pretty close to that threshold right now, which is why I would envision that policymakers have got to start acting. And it may be that Janet decides that she's going to run down the TGA rather faster. It may be that there are other means of actually getting liquidity into the system. Or it may be they go through the back door, as I've suggested, and start to issue a lot more bills. And those bills are effectively a way of reliquefying the system. But ultimately, the system needs more monetary liquidity. And the point that, you know, all our research and why this is such an important factor and why I keep hammering on about this is that we're in a world now that is very different from the textbook world. The textbook world tells us that interest rates are all that matter. You know, I put, for example, a piece out on our Substack, Capital Wars Today, which was saying, do Federal Reserve interest rates drive Bitcoin prices? Spoiler alert, no, they don't have any effect. What really matters is ultimately the fiscal arithmetic. Now, why is that so important? Let's put this in context. The textbook model says that interest rates drive the system, because what they're saying is we're in a world where capital spending is really driving the business cycle. So, you know, if we're in that world, I'll come quietly and say, well, I agree that a higher cost of capital will freeze out capital spending and what you'll see is a slower economy as a result. But hey, we're not in that world anymore. Nobody's really doing massive amounts of capital spending. Nobody's building you know, capital intensive plant like Chemical Works or Steelworks or whatever in the West, leave that to China. And that's not interest rate constrained. That's decided by the Politburo or whatever, or Xi Jinping or whoever of his acolytes decide those things. It's not about interest rates. It's not market driven. We're in a world now in the West where it's not about capital spending, but financial markets are refinancing mechanisms, not new financing mechanisms. And a world of refinancing is not the interest rate that matters. It's the capacity to roll the debt. And what I mean by refinancing is think of an example, a sort of homespun example of a home mortgage, right? If you've got a home mortgage, which is a 25-year mortgage, and it comes up to renewal after 25 years, you're not that interested necessarily, or at least on step one, on what the interest rate you pay is. What you're really desperate about is whether you can find a credit provider or a bank who's going to lend to you. Can you roll the debt over? Because if you can't roll the debt over, you're going to default and you're homeless. Okay, so it focuses the mind. In a world of massive debts, and we've got $350 trillion of debt worldwide with an average maturity of 5 years, which tells me there's $70 trillion of debt on average that you've got to refinance every year, which is about, what, a short three quarters of world GDP. But that's got to be refinanced every year by financial markets on top of what else they do. So financial markets are absolutely now refinancing mechanisms, and they basically overshadow new financing for capital spending about 4 or 5 to 1. So this is the world we're in. In other words, balance sheet capacity is absolutely critical. And balance sheet capacity is all about liquidity. And what drives that liquidity, the ability of the system to create liquidity, are the central banks and the availability of collateral. And that really is all it's about. So that's what we try and understand. And as that liquidity is increased, then you get a spillover into asset markets, you get asset price inflation, and ultimately you may even get high street inflation. But that's, you know, another story. So that's the liquidity generation mechanism.
Michael, I want to ask you about the refinancing that you mentioned. A lot of it takes place at the overnight treasury repo level. Mm-hmm. So we monitor SOFR volumes, which are basically yesterday's repo volume. Primarily, these are dealers that have treasury positions that are financing their inventory. We also know that in September 2019, we had a repo crisis because some of that collateral couldn't find repo funding, and it ended up with the Fed instituting a standing repo facility. My question to you is that in an ample reserves framework in which reserves are declining and the Fed has to then expand reserves again, there will be a signal from the market or from banks themselves that, hey, we're up against the restraint here. In September 2019, it was a repo crisis, but we have the standing repo facility today. So what is the market signal to tell us we are up against reserve constraint? How will we see it? Is it in the repo market or somewhere else?
I think the repo markets are a pretty good bellwether of this. You know a lot more about the repo markets than I do, but I would say that maybe it's not a fail-safe signal, because maybe you can get problems outside of this in other corners of the market. And I think one of the difficulties with, you know, the financial system at the moment is that it's complex, and there are areas that we're not really too sure about. For example, the shadow banking industry is one very clear example of that. Now, I'll give you, a couple of examples about this process. Number one is to say that every financial crisis you can think of in the last 2 or 3 decades has fundamentally been a refinancing crisis. Whether it's 2008 with the European banks needing to be ultimately bailed out by the Fed, whether it's the repo crisis in 2019, whether it's the Asian financial crisis, all these financial crises are basically about refinancing problems, okay? So this is why it's so important. If liquidity is not forthcoming, you get a problem. And what that tells you is that the relationship or the ratio between liquidity in the system and debt has got to be stable. And that's really the necessity. So if you see a rising debt GDP ratio for economies, and that's what most economists are predicting, you absolutely must have, for stability, a rising liquidity to GDP ratio, but we know that as the liquidity to GDP ratio rises, asset markets inflate. That's a fact. So you are going to get, over the longer term, monetary inflation and rising asset markets. That clearly has political implications in terms of wealth divides, but hey, that's a different area to think about. The other thing to say is that let's think about historical examples. And one of the things that I've often said is that the shadow banking industry today is an echo from what happened in the British financial system in the 19th century. Now, that seems a long step, but there's a direct parallel. There was a bank, if you call it a bank, but a financial institution called Overend Gurney, which basically went bust, and the Bank of England refused to bail it out. And that created a financial crisis in 1866. Now, the Overend Gurney institution was effectively what we'd call a shadow bank today. It was huge in the equivalent of the repo markets. It was a bill broker. And they basically ran into liquidity problems. And there was a shadow banking crisis then, but the Bank of England deliberately turned its back on Overend Gurney. And ultimately, what came out of that was the writings of Walter Bagehot, Lombard Street, and the Bank of England acting as lender of the last resort, which everyone now pretty much follows. Now, the point about that story is that one of the ways in the subsequent period that the governor of the Bank of England tried to detect whether there were problems in the money markets is that traditionally every Thursday he would don his top hat, which is what they wore in those days, and physically go out and walk the streets of the City of London around the money markets to see if he could detect whether there are any problems in terms of liquidity. And I'm not suggesting that that Jay Powell does that today, but you get my point that you've got to have a lot of feelers. It's not really a question of just looking at interest rates and saying, well, hey, interest rates are going to look after themselves and that's all we need to do. There's got to be an active understanding of the liquidity needs in the system when you've got so much refinancing to go on. Now, ultimately, the solution of this is to say, we'll get rid of debt. But that's impossible. Debt is the bogey that's sitting on top of us.
Yes, I'm sure that the New York Fed's open market operations desk is talking to dealers about their repo activity on a daily basis and communicating that back to the FOMC so that they understand where that reserve constraint is. And people should definitely go check out Walter Bagehot and the history of the Bank of England becoming the lender of last resort, because that does underpin the model for where we are today. I want to ask you one question about cross-border capital before I hand it back to Joe. Your firm is cross-border capital. It's also the component of your framework that I'm struggling the most with, because as a fixed income guy, I understand collateral values driving liquidity. And I also understand balance sheet expansion driving liquidity. But try to break down why you named your firm cross-border capital, why that's such an important component to understanding liquidity.
Very good point. It's because we're in a world where capital flows are important. And those capital flow shocks are often the factors that actually destabilize domestic financial systems. So if you see liquidity coming into a financial system, it tends to be, if you like, multiplied a number of times. You get these liquidity shocks. Now, I'll give you some examples of that. But broadly speaking, that's why cross-border capital is important. And perhaps think about these examples. And this is going to get maybe I'm going to try not to get stuck in the weeds here because it's quite a complicated area. But basically, capital flow shocks should influence what economists call the real exchange rate. OK, so if you get a big capital shift from the rest of the world into America, the US real exchange rate should go up. Now, what is the real exchange rate? It's the nominal dollar times some price index of US prices. Now, the reality is, in the modern world, is that high street prices and service prices are generally quite sticky. They don't move very much. And what takes all the impact is financial asset prices. So effectively, if you get that shock of liquidity coming in, a global capital flow, it's the nominal dollar which goes up and asset prices go up. Now, just think about what's happened in the last 15 years, right? What you've had since the global financial crisis, largely because of, I would argue, because of instability in the rest of the world and because of the Basel Accords, a lot of money is coming to US safe assets. So money is coming to the US system. What have you seen? You've seen the dollar rise and you've seen asset markets rise, okay? And that's a normal feature. What did you see in Japan in the 1980s? You saw a very similar feature. You saw capital coming into Japan. You basically saw the yen going up and you saw asset markets going up. Now, what happened in the middle 1980s was the US was very concerned about the strength of the dollar at that time for different reasons. And they basically said to the Japanese, what you've got to do is to try and loosen monetary policy. So in other words, don't let the yen appreciate so much and try and get the yen or try not to get the yen appreciating, pump liquidity into the system. And what they did is they took the kept the yen stable effectively and they inflated their domestic asset markets, causing a bubble. Now, that bubble ultimately burst and we've had, you know, a legacy of three decades of problems in Japan ever since. What happened in the emerging markets, the Asian emerging markets in the mid-90s? Exactly the same phenomena. Big capital inflows, pressure on real exchange rates to rise. Government said, we don't want to decouple from the US dollar, so let's actually keep our currencies flat. We'll pump in domestic liquidity, which is what they did, and overinflate a domestic asset bubble, which again burst when the capital flow retreated. What happened in China in the wake of 2010? You saw a similar factor. Capital coming in, the Chinese wanting to fix their currency against the dollar. So what they did is they eased monetary policy and you saw this huge bubble in Chinese asset prices. Exactly the same phenomena. I can give you more examples, Scandinavia in the early 90s. All these examples are very real examples. And what we've got to watch for is this movement of capital flow. When am I going to get worried about the US system is when you start to see a significant capital outflow leaving US assets. And I think there's a chart I'd probably send over in the pack, which actually looks at the difference between what's happening in terms of US capital flow and what's happening in terms of Chinese capital flow. And basically what you see is huge outflows from China in the last 15 years and huge inflows into the US dollar in the last 15 years. Consequently, US real exchange rate goes up, yeah? So nominal dollar rises, Wall Street rises strongly. China, real exchange rate goes down dramatically. Here's the chart for China, big capital outflows. Real exchange rate goes down in China, result yuan under pressure, but they tighten to try and stop the yuan falling. And Chinese asset markets are destroyed. Exactly, this, it's the classic unwind that we've seen time and time again. So this is why capital flows are important, because they ultimately are a cause of destabilization in the global financial system.
Now, I'm curious about the position of China and Japan. Are they selling treasuries as well at the same time as capital is actually flowing out of China and going into the dollar? I'm trying to understand how these large countries are managing their US Treasury position.
Yeah, I think that's part of that puzzle, but it's a separate question. And the fact is that China is reducing its treasury holdings. I think one could debate how fast. I think the unequivocal point is they're not expanding their treasury holdings as rapidly as they would have done in the past, given their swelling trade surplus. And traditionally, they've basically at the margin put a lot of that extra trade surplus into US securities, and they're clearly not doing that anymore. They're finding other vents for that. They're buying gold. They're going through what may be a reformed Belt and Road Initiative with physical investment. They're buying commodities. So they're trying to find other vents for that money. But I think that, you know, ultimately, that's what's going on. The problem is that China is, the real exchange rate is under pressure in China. And that's really what we've got to face. Now, in my view, what you see in this, if you like, capital flow unwind, is that the real exchange rate of China goes down. What would you expect to see in that environment? you'd expect to see price or asset deflation, or let's say price and asset deflation, and downward pressure on the nominal yuan. And I'd say tick all those boxes, because you've got deflation in the high street in China, you've got asset, huge asset deflation, and you've got downward pressure on the yuan. It's telling you absolutely that the real exchange rate is under downward pressure. And that's the normal adjustment mechanism that we see time and time and time again in the world economy.
Wonderfully said. We covered a lot, Michael. Nick, do you have anything else?
I want to ask one last question about term premium, because this is a concept that it goes back to your duration point from earlier, that if we have increased duration that hits the market, that this is going to affect liquidity. Term premium right now is the topic du jour. So explain to us how we should be looking at term premium. Is it a function of the QRA announcements? Is it a function of something else?
Yeah, I think it's, look, the what is term premium? Term premium is not something that anyone can calculate easily. It's a sort of wonkish concept. You've got to do a lot of math to actually extract it from the term structure. But it's a very important implicit component, because basically what the what a bond yield decomposes into is into two moving parts. One is interest rate expectations, and the other is, if you like, a risk premium called a term premium for actually holding the bond over the investment horizon and actually facing potential interest rate risk. So it's a compensation. What you're looking at the moment is a very anomalous situation, because the term premium, rather than being positive, being a compensation, is it's negative. An investor ultimately has to pay to the market to actually hold a bond. Now, that's really a head-scratching event, and it shouldn't happen. And the reason it's happening is there's basically been an artificial scarcity of Treasury coupon by the Federal by the US Treasury. Why has that happened? It's largely because there's big demand for safe assets in the system from banks and insurance funds, to a very large extent because of the Basel Accords, and because they keep saying that banks have got to hold more safe assets, and, you know, US Treasuries are the pristine safe asset in the system. So everybody wants to hold those. They're the most liquid instruments in the system. And, you know, I keep coming back to the point that if you look at the history of finance, the most important price in every financial system through time is the price of the dominant economy's debt. That is US Treasury bonds. That is absolutely key. The issue is that if you oversupply those treasuries, the price of those treasuries is not going to go up anymore. You're going to go down. It's this supply and demand. And that's basically what's happening. Despite the good efforts of the Federal Reserve, despite the good efforts and the subtleties of Janet at the Treasury, what you're facing in the US is a massive increase potentially in coupon debt issuance in the medium term. And as I keep saying, the US is the cleanest shirt in the global laundry here. Okay, I'm not hitting on the US. It just so happens it's easier to analyze because America is very transparent in its data. And the Congressional Budget Office gives us predictions out to 2050 of what basically the debt burden could be in terms of spending and taxation. So it's transparent, which makes it easier. But I assure you, every other country is in a far, far worse situation. Now, that debt issuance is clearly going to weigh on the treasury market. And the problem that we've gone into, which is why monetization is the important word to think about, while fiscal dominance is a concept to understand, and why Bitcoin and gold bullion and other crypto may be the way out of this for investors to try and negotiate these risks. And the problem is that if you start to think about what's happening here, the contrast with today, or contrast today with 1980. In 1980, when Volcker was at the Fed, US interest rates were 15%, right? So we're now at a third of those levels. But the debt burden is getting even bigger. The interest payments we've got to pay on the debt now exceed $1 trillion, more than the US defense budget. That focuses the mind, right? It is going to get worse. Why is it going to get worse? Because in 1980, the debt GDP ratio, the public debt GDP ratio, was 25%. Now it's 125%. It's five times bigger, and it's getting more. And by the magic of compound interest, which after all Einstein said is the eighth wonder of the world, and he, you know, he should know, by the dint of compound interest, what you've got is that these interest payments are escalating over time and they're compounding. And the issue that what this really means is that the standby that the monetary authorities always had in the past is to say, well, look, hey, we don't care about this because we can always discipline the markets, because what we'll do next year is we'll hike interest rates, we'll push people out of risk assets like equities, and we'll force them into government bonds, and then we can start the whole process again because we can fund ourselves at lower interest rates and everyone is cramming into the bond market because of the threat of recession. Trouble is they can't do that in the future because the interest bill is so high now that if they start pushing up interest rates and bond yields start to rise even more, the interest bill is going to shoot to the moon. It's going to be out of control. So their ability to move interest rates is very, very limited. So my view is that what you've got is a situation out there where interest rates don't move very much at the policy level. It's very difficult for Jay Powell to do very much in all honesty. You've probably got an upward sloping curve because of the pressures of term premium. Janet will try and offset that by basically saying, look, what's got to happen here is we're going to go through more bill issuance. We're going to try and restrict the amount of coupon that's coming onto the market. The Federal Reserve may hoover up more of that coupon so they go back to what is called QE, although they may rename it quantitative support, depending on what the acronym department of the Federal Reserve thinks up. But they're going to go down that route. But ultimately, what you're talking about here is fiscal dominance and monetary inflation. And in a world of fiscal dominance and monetary inflation, a 60-40 asset mix, equity bonds, is exactly the wrong mix. It won't work. What you need is radically lower bonds and more direct monetary inflation hedges like gold and cryptocurrencies. And that's why we're bullish on Bitcoin in the medium to long term. Because whatever you might say about the cycle, whether liquidity ebbs and flows in the next 12 months is not necessarily the point. The trend has got to be upwards for the simple reason that the fiscal regimes in every Western country are out of control because of mandatory spending, because of polarized politics in the domestic level, which means that you can't really effectively raise taxes without alienating your critical marginal voter. And at the global level, there's a polarization between us and China, which means that defense outlays have got to be much, much higher. So the fiscal arithmetic just doesn't work unless you've got monetization. And monetization means asset markets go up. So, you know, there's an old saying in Ireland, which is, if you want to get to Dublin, don't start from here. But that's where we are.
It sounds like a de facto yield curve control policy from the Treasury Department as they try to manage the shape of the yield curve and how much long-term debt is going to be issued. Michael Howell, Cross Border Capital, thank you so much for joining us once again at the Bitcoin Layer and for your tremendous insights and for teaching us so many things today. Please tell people where they can find your excellent work, Capital Wars Substack.
Okay, that's very kind. The institutional services are available at crossbordercapital.com. We provide data. A lot of quant funds use our data to run money. Narrative research is available there. And then we have a Substack, which is called Capital Wars, after the name of the book. That's available. And there's an occasional Twitter feed, which is at CrossBorderCap.
With Joe Consorti, I'm Nick Bhatia. We'll catch you guys next time. The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River.com/TBL for that special offer. And the reason that we love River at the Bitcoin Layer is that they put your education first. River.com/learn to understand what Bitcoin is, the fundamentals. Also, how to get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own custody solution. You can use river.com/learn for all of that information. Go check them out today.